No, I mean, architecture is political. We gotta add that stuff.
Indeed.
We're tearing down communities to build multifamily, and you have to understand we are creating displacement. You're displacing Black and Brown folks, and they don't come back.
Half of this podcast would be dedicated to the history of Tyler House, my journey and my discoveries, and hey, I'm gonna solve this housing problem.
Hey guys, what's up? My name is Melissa Daniels. This is the Architecture is Political podcast where Black and Brown folks talk about architecture. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and be part of my storytelling. For most African Americans involved in the study and practice of architecture, it does not take long to realize that something is amiss. A comment here, a history class there, a dubious and or obligatory urban design problem later on. Scant support for scholarly pursuits, and less than desirable majority office project assignments. A shortlist snub, a questionable joint venture, division of work, and or a perfunctory firm interview all help to illustrate this dynamic. It takes a little while longer for many African Americans to understand that the prevailing, underlying, and unyielding attitude of resistance they constantly encounter has less to do with their ability to teach or practice architecture, and much more with something more slippery and elusive. Succinctly put, their failure is not necessarily a failure to know something, but a failure to be something. This changed my life, guys. I'm reading from The Aesthetics of Equity by Craig L. Wilkins. I can't remember when I got this book. It was published back in 2007. I graduated in 05. That's a very long time ago. And I hated architecture when I graduated. And so I jumped into the construction side. I loved that job. I thoroughly loved that job. I loved the people, and I got to look at different sets of drawings. It was great. But I realized that I didn't want to do concrete all my life. I didn't want to do post-engineering all my life. And looking at other people's drawings, other firms' drawings, I jumped into architecture again. And I've felt this feeling, what I just read to you, not only in architecture school, but in practice as well. When Dr. Craig Wilkins hit me up in an email with an opportunity, first of all, I was floored. I was like, am I reading this right? I can't believe that he listened to this podcast, one. And then wanted to work with me on something that unfortunately didn't fall through. But I had his email, as I mentioned in this episode, and I shoot my shot. I actually asked Kelly Beeman, who has been on the show a couple of times. I used her as a crush. Was like, hey, can you talk to me, please? And needless to say, he agreed. So Dr. Craig L. Wilkins is in the building, not physically in my building, but he was, I don't know where he was, but he was at his location and I was at mine. And I dragged Kelly along for this interview as well to talk. I listened to this interview maybe about 5 times. And every single time I listened to it, I gained a new, I don't want to say perspective. I gained ways to express myself. One thing I loved about this book, again, The Aesthetics of Equity, is the way that he broke it down. He did 2 parts. Let me just backtrack. He has authored other books. This is the book that changed my perspective. And there's another book too that did that, that led me to stay in this field. 2024 minus 2005 years later. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. It's one of the highlights of doing this podcast is to talk to authors and to people who affected your life that they had no clue that you were even affected. So here you go. Thank you again, Craig, for coming on. Dr. Craig Wilkins, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm looking forward to it. I love this podcast, so I feel honored to be on it.
I've been a fan of yours for a long time. I have a wish list
I have actually there's two. There's a celebrity list, right? People that actually want to talk to, but they're like celebrities. And then there's the wish list of practitioners and authors and so forth. And you were on there. So when you approached me last year sometime, first of all, I was like, he knows I exist. Like, how is this possible?
Of course, I know you exist. And I'm sorry that project fell through. I was kind of getting excited about it, but that was out of my hands. It was sponsored by another institution, and the young lady who was running it decided to take another job. And so that was
Yeah, but I had your email though, and I was
that.
in 2024, I'm gonna shoot my shot, and I did, and now you're here, so
I am.
thank you so much. So you've been in this game for a long time. You have several books out there. You've done panels. You did a TED Talk. You've done a lot of things, and I was thinking, what questions that I can ask that hasn't already been answered? I had the same. I don't want to say issue, but challenge when I talked to Maple Wilson. And so it was like, and I still end up asking questions that she, like, this is new to me. So I apologize in advance for any of repeat questions.
Don't even worry about it. I mean, everybody has different audiences. So if you end up going over stuff that maybe I've talked about in other places, that's fine. My thinking may have evolved on it.
Good point. I want to focus on your thoughts and opinions as a writer in this industry. I read The Aesthetics of Equity a long time ago, and I was like, oh, I got to reread this book. I picked up and started reading, but I haven't had an opportunity to read it completely.
Well, that's quite all right. I usually recommend it if people have insomnia, just keep it on your nightstand and
No.
put you right out.
No, and it's very meaty. This book, along with White Papers, Black Marks from Leslie, the anthology of that book. And between those two books, it helped me. This is why I'm still here, along with physical people, with other architects, seeing what they go through, Black and Brown, especially Black women, see what they have to deal with, go through. From a practice sense, you guys helped me out so much because I was feeling out of place. I was feeling like something's wrong. And I interpret that as something's wrong with me instead of something's wrong with the system of architecture and the system of the practice of architecture. Your book allowed me to understand like the history. And it helped me understand the differences of being Black here. I just want to thank you for that. And just questions that I have of that is, how did you get this published? Let's start off with that.
Well, first, let me say you're welcome. I don't speak for Leslie, although I have spoken with her on numerous occasions. I do think she probably would agree with this, but again, I'm speaking for me. That's why I wrote the book, because I experienced, so I'm not sure when you were in school, and you don't have to say, but it certainly was after me. So if you felt out of place, imagine how I felt 30 some odd years ago. And I have a, I don't know if this is the right term, I have a confidence that borders on arrogance sometimes, most of the time, all the time. And
You're an architect.
well, this is true. I tell my students, like, if you don't have a very healthy ego, then this is not the field for you. It's not the field for you. But, and I grew up in a fairly socially conscious, culturally conscious, racially conscious family. And I just knew that my experience wasn't an isolated experience for people who looked like me. And I wanted to address that experience as if for no other reason than to just be cathartic about it. But the other reason, and probably the more important reason, was for what you just mentioned, is that if I'm going through this, I know other people are going through this. So let me try to figure out what this is about, and then I can share it. And so people will feel less isolated, perhaps maybe turn some of that doubt outward and not inward. This is sort of why I did it. Now, getting it published, that is another thing entirely. I think I sent it to about 10 or 12 presses, and all but one told me that they were not interested for a variety of reasons. Oh, we already have something like this in the pipeline, or, oh, this doesn't really fit our titles, or for whatever reason. And I have all of those letters. I framed every single one of them. And I framed right along with it the one publisher, University of Minnesota Press, that accepted the manuscript. And then I have, in that same, it's a big frame. And in that frame, I have the cover of my book and the two awards that it won. And I don't know how you want to edit this, but I'm just going to say it the way I explain it to other people when they come to my home. I say, this is my fuck you board. All you guys missed out. Now, you know, 10 publishers is not really a big deal. People get rejected all the time for, again, for a variety of reasons. I happened to luck up on one on number 10. Even that was fraught with its own problems. That book was delayed for 2 years. I had an editor who, I don't know, he just kind of ghosted me. So much so to the point where I had to fly. I was already in, where was I at the time? I think I was already here in Michigan. I had to fly into Minneapolis unannounced and go to his cubicle and surprise him. Because if I told him I was coming, I felt he was not going to be there. So I just confronted him. I'm like, why are you dragging your feet on this book? Why are we a year and a half behind schedule? He told me straight up, your book's just not a priority for me. Now, it's already in production. I can't take it anywhere else. I've already signed a contract. They're just sitting on it. And so once he told me that, I went straight to, I don't know, calling the publishing director or director of the press or whomever. And of course, I surprised him too. I said, do you know what? I'm not going to out him, but do you know what so-and-so said about my book? He told me to my face, it's not a priority. Is it a priority for you? It was out the next 6 months. But that editor is still on the press. I don't know if it was just me. I don't know if it was a personal thing. I don't know if he sits on all books that deal with this kind of material. But even when it was accepted and was in the process, it still was fraught with obstacles that should not have existed. How did I get it published? A lot of legwork, a lot of pressure, a lot of, I'm not going to be treated this way. Have you read this book? Do you know what it's about? I see your machinations and I'm not going to allow that to happen. You should have known that.
Where were you in your life when this was happening?
I had just relocated to University of Michigan. I believe it was the time that I was on a one-year fellowship, the Sojourner Truth Fellowship in Urban Planning. I'm pretty sure that's where I was. I had already gotten my doctorate. The book came out of the dissertation. I had really completed whatever educational trajectory I was on. I was done. And now I was situating myself within the scholarly world of architecture.
Your university had their own press and they didn't want to touch that.
No, that was the one press that did.
Okay.
I do remember University of Virginia Press, primarily because my second book, they really wanted that one. I was like, yeah, okay. They caught the vapors. And so it was Yale, Princeton. Those are the ones I can remember off the top of my head. But University of Minnesota Press, they were the ones who accepted it.
So I can't remember how I got my hands on this book. I don't know if someone recommended to me or I cannot remember how I got this, but you got the copy. And so did you promote this yourself or did you?
Of course I did. So let me clarify this a little bit, because I don't want to make it sound like, you know, this was some sort of heroic effort on my part. Academic presses and trade presses are different. So academic presses exist primarily to publish scholarly work. Most all of them are nonprofit. And in some ways, it's the arm of the institution itself. It's just yet another way to participate in the education of the public. And so they aren't so concerned with turning an excess profit. Now, they have to make enough money to stay in business and continue to publish books. But for the most part, they're there to support the scholarly efforts of academics and scholars, not just across the United States, but across the world, actually. Where a trade publication, the stuff that you find in bookstores and other places, they are for-profit entities. And so if they accept a manuscript, they want it to sell, and they want it to sell as much as possible. And they, almost all of them, I can't think of one that doesn't have a press office or PR office, because they're not going to invest that money in producing this book and not try to do their best to sell it. That's not necessarily how academic presses work. And so when I say I did all the PR for it, it's not uncommon for that to happen. I know that I did a lot more than my colleagues did or have done or still do to get it out into the world, because again, I didn't write it just to try to get tenure. As a matter of fact, when I wrote it, I didn't even have a tenure track job. So my objective was a little different. My objective was, hopefully I would use it to get a tenure track job, but that wasn't necessarily the goal. The goal was really to say to people like you and I, look, it's not you. What you're feeling is justified, and here's the reason why. What you are perhaps angry about is a justifiable anger. If you feel like you're being ignored, you are, and this is the reason why. So it was perhaps in a way to equip people to address these issues where they felt they could, and where they felt they couldn't, they could say, well, you know what? This has a long history. I'm probably not going to be able to change much of it on my own, but at least I feel a little bit better about what's happening.
What kind of reactions have you gotten, not only with this book, but everything else have you written, whether it be articles or other books? How has the white audience received this? I just told you my perspective as a Black person.
Yeah. So Aesthetics is written in two parts. Well, it's a book that was written twice. One in a language of, you know, sort of the high scholarly lingo, lexicon. And that was primarily me talking to primarily white audience. Because the topic was about the systemic issues within architecture that place unnecessary obstacles in the way of Black progress, I knew it was a topic that nobody really wanted to address. And so I had to present it in a way that it would be very difficult for them to dismiss it out of hand. Like, you may disagree with it, but you can't dismiss it. And so to do that, I had to use a language that, and a process, like, it's heavily footnoted so that folks would know that this is just not my opinion, it's actually researched. So that was the first book. And I knew that people who didn't have a scholarly bent, but who really needed to have access to this book, like you and I and other folks who look like us, that would be off-putting to them. That's not the language that they use with each other. That's not how they explain their position in the world to other colleagues. So I wanted them to get exactly what I was arguing to perhaps a white audience. And so that was the second part of the book, the part that's called the remix. I wanted to write it in a language and a lingo that was easily accessible. And you go, oh, yeah, I got that. So that's what you're saying up there? Oh, I get it. So it was really written for two audiences. So how was it received? Well, most of the feedback I got came from people who looked like you and I. I did not get a lot of feedback from, by the time the book came out, I had secured a better academic situation. So it wasn't tenure track, but I was a director of the design center in Detroit. But most of my colleagues at the time at Michigan and at other conferences and other places, they were kind, but they really didn't delve too deeply into the message in the book. It was only my other scholarly colleagues, students who had read the book, and some professionals who were overly supportive.
Fast forward to 2020, a couple of things happened during that year. Besides COVID, a couple of our people was murdered. And I imagine that your emails were blowing up.
They were.
How did you handle that?
Well, this is interesting because a lot of things came together out of this horrifically tragic and totally avoidable incident for me. So when I mentioned that I had secured this position as a director of the design center, by this time I had made a complete change in my vision for what I wanted to be as an architect, how I felt I could be useful in the world. When I graduated, just like every other architect, starting out architectural student, at least back in the 80s, everybody wanted to be on a magazine. Everybody wanted to be the head designer. Everybody wanted to be, you know, win all the awards. And we are a competitive and in many ways, self-centered bunch. We've already talked about that. So that's what I wanted to do. And when I graduated, I said, I'm the shit. And I am going to go and work for a black firm. I'm not going to give all this talent to a white firm. I'm going to give it to a black firm. And every place I went for interviews, I got a job offer. I finally took a job in Washington, D.C. at Devereaux & Parnell. Still friends with those people to this very day, which is a plug for working with a black firm. And it was great. It was fantastic.
Were you there when I was there?
I left Devereaux and Parnell in 1988.
I was not there.
Yeah. And then I went with Perkins and Will for a couple of years, and then I went back to grad school. So anyway, so I got this position at the design center. And by this time, my purpose had changed. I wanted to be more participatory. I wanted to work with communities, not for communities. I wanted to work in areas that needed professional services but couldn't afford them, or were getting services that were less than culturally compatible. And so taking over the design center allowed me to do that. However, at the time, I had a faculty member, high up faculty member, actually was in administration, who just told me straight up, and this was in 2015, who just told me straight up, no, I'm sorry, 2005, I take that back, not 2015, 2005, who told me straight up, oh, you'll never get tenure doing that. You'll never get tenure working in distressed neighborhoods and communities, and that's not tenurable work. So I'm going to admit this, and I shouldn't admit this, because this is going to be easily accessible to people around the world, but I am negatively motivated. If someone tells me I can't do, I will kill myself.
Hence the fuck you wall, right?
Yes, yes, yes. To prove you wrong. How dare you put a limit on what I can and cannot do? That's just, I'm not going to accept it. I'm just not.
Amen.
Thank you, Kelly. So I just, you know, I nodded and I went on and did my thing. I'm like, if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down doing the thing that I believe in. I'm not going to change it just to fit in or be suitable or get the accolades that would come with that decision. That wasn't worth it to me. I continued working on issues of race and space, ended up falling into this idea of hip hop architecture, basically coming from a culturally specific perspective. You know, I was getting published, I was being accepted at conferences to speak. That slowly morphed into people inviting me to speak. It had some legs, the stuff that I was told would not be tenurable material. It had legs, but they were tiny legs. They didn't move all that fast, but they were moving. Then there was Ferguson, there was George Floyd, to a certain degree, Tavon, and all these sorts of moments where the lives of Black people in urban conditions were being curtailed even more violently than they had been in the past. Maybe I won't even say more violently. It just got more attention. That's probably a better term for
it. It was recorded.
Yeah, there you go.
And people could see it, yeah.
Right. And so, although Rodney King was recorded and nothing happened there.
True.
But then the Floyd thing happened and I wrote a piece, and I think it was in Architecture Daily or the Architects newspaper. One of those things, I was talking to Diane Butts, and so it was sort of a conversation that made its way into this article. And I started getting a lot of phone calls and I got a lot of solicitations, because I basically was saying that this is, you know, architecture and urban planning has a lot to do with why the streets are on fire right now. And we have yet to accept our responsibility in the role that we have played in this. And until we do, we're just going to continue to replicate conditions that foster this kind of wanton assassinations across the board.
How have we been compliant in this, for audience sake? You got to say it in less than like
the time that we have. Oh God, I don't know if I can.
Because you can go in. I know you can.
Let me put it this way. The line on a sheet of paper turns into the street that gets built. So we have a lot of power to shape the built environment. And when we are complicit in the hoarding of resources, parks are in this neighborhood, parks are not in that neighborhood. Transportation has easier access in one neighborhood where it doesn't in another neighborhood. Tax bases are unevenly spread around our neighborhoods and our communities. We are complicit and following and continuing things like operating on the soft power, because it's illegal now, but we're on the soft power of redlining. We're not going to invest in those neighborhoods, but we're going to invest in these neighborhoods. We participate in that process. We participate in hoarding resources away from some groups and protecting them, and then turning a blind eye and say, well, we're just doing what our clients tell us to do. That's not enough. So your clients tell you to be racist, so that's what you're going to do. You have to have a little bit more moral and ethical fortitude than that.
So I'm gonna introduce the audience to Kelly Beeman, a regular on this show, because I love her so much. And she is so rich. And especially topics like this, like I love having Kelly on when I have other writers in the room, because I feel that I've always said this in previous episodes that I got to see in English, and that writing is an art form that I'm still learning how to master. So when I have journalists and authors on here, I love to hear both of them interact with each other so that they can talk about that craft. Kelly, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. And I, you know, I'm a big fan of Craig Wilkins and very grateful to have been connected with him in the one, probably the one important piece that I ever wrote. I have to be honest. I haven't had a whole lot of opportunities. So what you were just saying, and I'm the weirdo in the room, right? Because I'm not a designer. I'm a Black person who's stumbled into journalism and this beat. And that gives me like a reason to get up in the morning and do some things. But I also feel the struggles personally. And when you just mentioned a lot of firms maybe talking about why they're not doing things or ways that they may be complicit, but oh, it's accidental. I wring my hands about that too. I have a problem with the term community engagement right now because I feel it gets thrown around. And of course, you both are practitioners, so you'll know a little better than I do, but it gets thrown around and sort of like, well, that covers it. Well, they said they did community engagement, but what does that really mean? And then I speak to end users who are people like politicians or business owners in a community on this level where they don't really connect with Black architects and they don't really know if they have the power to influence an RFP or a process where they're allowed, you know, they can expand the bidding. I don't feel like they know how to connect. My question is, how do we make that happen?
Well, I want to finish that answer to the earlier question, and then I'm going to pick up on that. So about the George Floyd moment in 2020, all of a sudden, all the things I had been writing about for the last 20 years, all of a sudden became, oh, we've been ignoring that. We've been hearing it, but we've ignored it. And this is why I got a lot of emails saying, oh, can you come talk to us about this? Can you do this, do that? It was also when around that time, people started to try to slide into that area of, oh, we need to start thinking more about how architecture is complicit. The things that I had been talking about for 20 years, all of a sudden became sexy. And now everybody wants to be in that area. And it was also around that time that the university started taking my scholarship fairly seriously. You know, I received tenure and all these other sorts of things. And of course, this was contradictory to what I was told 20 years ago, like you'll never get tenure with this. Part of the point is that stay the course. If you find this important and useful, then that's what you should be doing. The rewards came, they came later. But they also came every year I stayed, continued to do what I wanted to do because I thought it was important. And it turned out that I was right. Now, Kelly, I guess part of this is a continuation of this story or my answer to Melissa is when I got a lot of phone calls. Can you come talk to us about this? And, you know, we see that you've been writing about that. And, you know, we see the work that you've done in the design center. And we really want to understand. We really want to start to have a conversation about how architecture is complicit. What can we do better? All those sorts of hand-wringing kind of, are we really complicit in this? We need to have someone talk to us about this. And maybe at the beginning, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'll come, we'll talk. And after a while, I stopped because I realized they weren't ready to have a conversation. You know, this is part of, and this may not make it into the published part of the podcast, but this is white pathology about responsibility. And what I realized is that what they wanted me to do is give them a list of things for them to do. And then they could choose which ones they wanted to do, which ones they didn't want to do. And the ones that they wanted to do, if for some odd reason didn't work, then it's my fault. Well, we tried it. It didn't work. So let's just go back to the way things were. And I refused to give them that out. I said, you need to have a conversation first amongst you and your group or your school or your entity, whatever it is, and then tell me where you are and I'll tell you whether you're ready to have a conversation with me or not. Because I'm not going to give you a list. I'm not going to do it because you have to do the hard work, not me. I already know you have to do the hard work. And I stopped getting phone calls. because I'm not going to give you a list. We can get somebody else to give us a list.
Yes. That's frustrating because I feel like I see that playing out often in the coverage of Black architects. There's so few architecture critics. The things that you're saying, I want to see as a column in the New York Times. I want to see as a column in the Los Angeles Times, authored by you. And those people don't seem to let go of those jobs. They've got a stranglehold on those positions. And instead, you have some who have, being plain, right? White writers who have a relationship with that title, legacy relationship. You know, they came up in the game. They've got a friend who works there, a relative who works there. And it happens like that. It's not like this the highest paying job, but you get in there and those are the ones who get an editor on the phone and say, I have a story, and can pitch it and get a slot. And so what happens is then someone I'm working on, a source, not all the time, but I'm saying they reach that person. It's like, oh, we want to be in Arc Digest. We want to be in these big publications. But what you're doing is enriching the reputation of this journalist who sometimes can't really properly present the issue. That's my opinion. And I think it's the same thing that you're talking about. They are getting that list from those people. And you know, right, look, I get it. They need exposure. You need to know about Kimberly Dowdell. You need to know about Michael Ford. You need to know what is happening. And it's nice to see them get the recognition. But there's also another agenda that I notice among some of the white journalists, because it's become, they're hoarding this sort of like beat. And it's a weird thing, but it's creating this prestige. And I feel there's a danger that it falls into a kind of just a shallow tokenism. And then when Black History Month or whatever is over, you know, they go back to whatever else.
Yes, I do not disagree with any of that at all. But I want to sort of turn this in a sense to back to your earlier question about how the term community engagement is, you know, a buzzword now. And like sustainability was maybe 20, 25 years ago, it's being emptied of all meaning. And it's not being emptied in a way that, oh, everything now, all processes understand that there has to be a community engagement component. We really don't really have to talk about it specifically because we've all embraced it. Not in that sense. It is being emptied in a sense that it's a buzzword that doesn't mean anything. Or it can mean anything. It could mean, oh, well, we gave a presentation to a local Black association, so we've engaged the community. No, you haven't really engaged the community. When there's a real substantive engagement, your power is shared. You know, it's not hoarded. There's this famous diagram. I can't remember the lady's name. I think her name is Sherry Aronson. That she does this ladder of participation. And at the bottom, in some ways, I don't remember the exact nomenclature. But at the top of the ladder is true power sharing, recognizing that everybody's bringing some expertise to the table, and that expertise should be embraced, incorporated. Not everybody's going to get their way. Everyone gets heard. And the product that comes out of it is just better across the board. And it's hard for architects and municipalities and professionals to acknowledge that their expertise is not the only expertise. And their way of getting that expertise, i.e. through licensure or education or a degree or being voted into an office or being tapped by a governor or a mayor, those acknowledgments of expertise are not necessarily available or even desired by lots of people who know things. And so if you don't have that kind of anointment, those who do don't necessarily embrace those who don't. And that true acknowledgement across the board of those who do and those who don't, recognizing that even those who don't have something to offer, have some expertise, and possibly more or deeper expertise than those who have been anointed. Without that recognition, there is no real true community engagement. It just doesn't happen. And so I think it's fair to critique. What do you mean by community engagement? I mean, what is your, how do you define that? But again, those who have been anointed don't want to have to define it. So when you say, well, how come this initiative was already fully developed? And then you just go to the communities and say, well, what do you think about this? We can tweak this, that, and the other thing. Versus we have an idea, let's go and develop it together. That's not how people have been taught, people have been trained, and they're scared because they don't control the process anymore. And control of the process is everything.
Fast forwarding to now, 2024, a lot of things has been happening in the world besides Trump's golden tennis shoes that he's selling for $400. Book bans, Supreme Court has ruled affirmative action is no more. DEI initiatives are disappearing. People are getting laid off. That looks like us. How do you foresee these affecting our profession? Do you think they're going to ban your book?
When you were saying that, I thought about that. If they knew it existed, then yeah, I think it would be banned. In Florida, I think it would be banned for sure. I'd look at this in a couple of different ways. I think our profession is facing a real, both a real tangible and existential crisis. And I think we have yet to even begin to think about the consequences of AI in our profession. So for example, if we are the design, one of the things that we sell is primarily, the primary thing that we sell is that we are aesthetic experts. Can we really even make that claim anymore when AI is available to almost everybody? I mean, we have to bring something more to the table than that. And I think part of our disquiet is we're asking, well, what else do we bring? I think that is, you know, sort of an existential crisis that we have to come to grips with. More tangible or in the immediate, I don't know that book banning, or the, let's put it this way, the impotence for book banning, which spreads to what is taught in school and what kind of policies we're going to spend our time building and focusing and trying to get past. I'm not sure those things, yes, they do affect architecture, right? Because they affect what gets built. In some ways, they affect architecture because some things that you might want to talk about in class may run afoul of whatever these policies are, like don't say gay or all these other sorts of things. So yes, it affects us. It affects us in the sense that it's not just architecture, it's just education in general. I don't see the normal sort of process of building to be tied to this underlying resurgence of white supremacy. Because people are still going to build buildings. They're still going to want this, any other thing. I think particularly for us as practitioners and educators of color, maybe it becomes problematic because maybe you don't get invited to submit your RFQs. Maybe you get a token interview. They don't really take you seriously. But that stuff has been happening forever. I don't know. I'd have to think a little bit more about how that really affects the profession in general and us specifically in the field of architecture.
So going into like AIA, for example, right? And they're still doing the DEI stuff. And, you know, we have a Black woman now as president, the CEO or CFO. She's also a Black woman. In terms of that, right? So you have leaders of the AIA who look like me, right? Do you think that there's going to be a backlash? Because I feel is already there. It just hasn't been in the forefront, right? Like all these DEI things, and I've seen comments all throughout. Can we just go back to building? Why are we talking about this? I need more clients. That sort of thing.
Yeah. DEI is another thing that is troublesome, like community engagement. I love the spirit, but again, it is really becoming empty of meaning. If history has taught us anything, and I'm talking recent history from 2004, it is that the old ways die hard. They die hard and they don't die easily. There's always a death throw before things move forward. 2004, was it? Yeah, 2004, we get the first African-American president in the United States. For 8 years, no personal scandals. Like everybody else, the president made some very good choices, some questionable choices, and some bad choices. Every president does that. His daughters were exemplary. His wife, smart, intelligent, supportive, independent, and they were a young family. And what people really often don't talk about is that he was raised by a single mother. Like Bill Clinton, raised by a single mother. Everything that you want in a president, everything. He was intelligent. He could connect with people. He was well-respected around the world. Everything that you would want. Frighten the hell out of those people in power. They just could not find anything to bring him down. So 2 terms are up. The sentiment is, we're not having any more of that. We're not having any more of that. Because that is going to lead to us not being in power anymore. That is a coalition that we cannot control. Again, this is the death throes, right? We get Donald Trump. The antithesis of everything that I just said to you. The absolute antithesis of it. Thrice divorced. Children have no jobs on their own. They get their jobs from their father. And those are sort of, you know, perhaps out of bounds kind of personal positions, but I'm using it as a way to sort of explain this. Policies begin to be rolled back that are progressive and that people seem to like. They spent 8 years trying to get rid of what they call Obamacare when everybody enjoyed it. Everyone benefited from that. So we get the backlash. We get white angst, white grievance. We get white supremacy. We get Donald Trump. Now, am I saying that the AIA is going to go through something similar? I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is, I wouldn't be surprised.
And that's my fear, right? I think, and no one is preparing for that. No one's talking about it. No one's looking at it from that lens. It's kind of like riding this wave.
I just want to ask you both something based on what Melissa is saying about that fear. Is there within the AIA an opportunity for members to address that fear, because there is a lobbying arm? They have a connection to certain representatives or what have you.
Well, Kelly, I'm not quite sure what you're lobbying who. Are you saying external lobbying or internal lobbying?
Externally.
Okay, externally. Well, I don't know. You have to remember that as soon as Donald Trump gets into office, AIA puts out a statement like, we're behind him. And that came from the president or the CEO or whatever position Robert Ivey had. And the body said, hey, wait a second, we didn't vote on this. You can't just put this out in our name without at least letting us have some say in it. But that was the first reaction. And you can go back and read the statement.
So it's, you know, it has this description as this bipartisan political action committee under AIA.
As a way to answer the question about, is there perhaps maybe some backlash because we have these two women in a position of authority within a traditionally white, male, heterosexual, elitist institution. And there is a corollary between the White House and AIA. That's the only reason I brought it up, right? Everybody's free to buy into whatever political position they want. I hope that they are critical enough to sort of understand what they're doing. But I'm more interested in what happens inside the institution of the AIA and other institutions as well. AIA isn't the only institution. It's a member's institution. You can be an architect and not be an AIA, right? There are other institutions. There's SARA, which is Society of American Registered Architects. There's ALA, which is American Licensed Architects. There are other entities that exist that if you don't want to follow whatever the AIA is doing, you know, you can join that, or you're free not to join anything at all. My concern, I'm a member, I'm not a member in good standing in all those that I just mentioned, because I don't pay any dues anymore. My concern is that there will be a backlash, especially if Kim, and I know her peripherally, I've known of her for quite some time, and I know that she's very savvy. She wouldn't be in that position if she wasn't. She's very smart. Again, wouldn't be there if she wasn't. But I know that she has some things that she would like AIA to do, and she's explained that to them. But saying it and doing it are two different things. And saying it and get people to help you do it are two different things. And so if you want to make a more diverse body of professionals and educators and students, that takes work and that takes commitment. And it's probably not going to happen completely. As a matter of fact, I know it won't happen completely in her term. That means at some point, the body itself is going to have to carry on the work that was started. And my fear is that they won't, unless they have someone in that position continually pushing for that change. And if we have that backlash that I mentioned, that new person will not push for that change.
Wrapping this up, and it's the last question, and I kind of like the way how I wrote it.
Of course you do.
I'm just going to read it. Are you growing weary of the current challenges and complexities of this field? In other words, sir, are you tired of this bullshit?
Yes, I am. In a nutshell, yes, I am. But I've been tired from the moment I got into this field. So it's just the norm. I go back to, actually, my niece actually got me this sweatshirt with this quote on it. It's so awesome. I've actually worn it so much that it's like beginning to fade now. And I got to figure out another way to get it. It's a quote from James Baldwin. And he says, to be a Negro and relatively conscious in this country is to be in a rage all the time. All the time. I am in a rage all the time. The thing is, what do you do about it? How do you manage it? Right? So am I tired of being in a rage? Yes, I am. But it is, in a sense, who I am now. I don't really know how to answer. I mean, I answer the question emphatically, yes. But tomorrow I'm going to get up and do the same things I've been doing today.
How's your blood pressure? I mean, that's what it is, right? It's your health. It's your mental and physical health.
Yes. My blood pressure is fine. My mental health, that's an issue. I'm not a tolerant person from the get-go, and my tolerance level is really getting small.
Don't start and I won't be none.
Absolutely. Y'all don't want to mess around and find out, so don't mess around. I don't know. I mean, look, I don't want to make this sound like I'm a hero. I'm not. I'm not. I'm just another person in this field who, sees something that they think needs to be addressed. So I address it. And for better or worse, it's just sort of part of, I don't think I'm made to be complicit. I find injustice intolerable wherever I encounter it. And I don't know that I wish I was a different person. Like some people say, I wish I didn't care. No, I want to care because it's the people who care actually try to make something different. Right. So I don't wish to be another person, to be different. I am who I am, and I have to figure out a way to make my way in the world that is beneficial to me, but also beneficial to the things that I care about. And I care about architecture because that's my tool, or one of my tools, my major tool. I care about architecture being kind to those who have to encounter it. I care about the field having a moral and ethical backbone. I care about whether we are simply whores who allow ourselves to be used by the highest bidder. Our skills are way more important than that. They are way more critical. They affect, they're way more influential. And we need to zealously guard them and not let them be used for purposes that we don't agree with. So I get up in the morning and those things are on my mind. And I think on that day, how can I work on this? How can I, get this out of my head and into the world? So I teach, practice, I talk. But to me, those things are, they're not separate. They're just all part of the same project.
Any last words, Kelly?
Just thank you. Thank you. I know what you mean about that feeling and people who keep working as you do. I know it's a heavy emotional load and you carry it well. Thank you.
Well, that's very kind of you. Very kind of both of you, actually. And to have me on, I really appreciate it. This is not normally it's the cadence in which I talk. I talk a lot and very fast. And so I'm purposely trying not to, because we were talking off air that I can get lost in the weeds with things. Like right now, I'm just trying to say bye, and I'm like taking 10 minutes to do that.
I'm like looking at the clock because I know that we have, because you have a time limit. So I was like, I'm gonna wrap this up and give it like an extra 10 minutes. That's what.
I appreciate you being willing to ride this roller coaster. And I hope that something decent comes out of it and it's useful. And I didn't waste anybody's time. So thank you again.
No, never. This has been an honor for me again. Been a fan of yours for a very long time. And thank you, Kelly, also for hopping on here. Kelly and I was like, what? He said, yes. Oh
Oh,
my goodness. So thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you again, Craig. Thank you again, Kelly.
thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Architecture's Political Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode and found it informative or at least entertaining. If you like what you heard, please share with others. You can also connect with Arcus Poly on social media, currently on Instagram as well as Facebook and Twitter. If for more information, visit us on our website. It's arcuspoly.online, ArchiPolly.online. I also want to thank our loyal supporters who have been with this podcast for at least 3 years. It means the world to me, and I'm totally grateful to have you part of this community. I will try to bring you the best content as possible, and I can't wait to share more amazing episodes with you. If this is your first time listening, or just like a particular episode, or all of them, you can support this podcast by going on glow.fm/arcispoly. Again, thank you for your support. It means the world to me, and thank you so much for listening.